Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
This is Open House live across Australia. It's great to have your company tonight. Now to the second instalment in the series we kicked off on week one, A Spectator's Guide to the Bible. We're taking an ambitious adventure through the entire Bible with author, commentator, historian, documentary maker, church minister, and my mate, John Dixon, who's also the head of the Centre for Public Christianity. Great to have you with
great
us.
Great to be here, Lee.
Thank you so much.
Anytime.
Let's recap briefly first. Our first instalment to the Spectator's Guide to the Bible, where did we finish up last week?
I basically said everything's good.
I like
because,
that.
Because that's what the text of Genesis says. In fact, for the slow people, it says it seven times. And of course,
that's why I got it.
Seven is the number of sort of wholeness and perfection in Hebrew thought. So the fact that the writer of Genesis 1 says, and God saw that it was good, God saw that it was good, seven times, until the seventh he goes, God saw everything he made, and it was very good. Yes. So that's there just for the silly ones who didn't quite get it the first time. And really what it's trying to say is that the whole creation and human beings in connection with the creation, connection with good, with God, is actually good. The first statement of the Bible, the first building block of the Christian worldview, is incredibly positive. It's an affirmation of the richness and beauty and value of life.
And without wanting to engage in religious flame wars, it is different from other worldviews, other religions.
Well, it is. I mean, particularly ancient religions. At the time in which Genesis was put together, the ancient world thought of creation and humanity as afterthoughts, right? There's no rhyme or reason, no great coherence, certainly no love relationship between the maker and human beings. And Genesis comes along and says, don't be stupid, there's a wonderful love relationship between God and human beings and with the creation. So it is definitely critiquing ancient religion. But I think it is also a powerful critique of contemporary secularism or atheism that says the same thing pretty much, that the world is accidental, that the world came into existence entirely accidentally through laws that have no consciousness, and we are the accidental result of billions of years of development, of evolution, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, Richard Dawkins will say. Well, Genesis says, fooey to that. You know, God has crafted this and has placed us at the center of it. It amounts to a radical rejection of the secular view.
So if everything is good, I remember you saying it has implications for really everything for us, from work to each other to the future.
It does. It means when you go to work, you're not doing something that is sort of just a necessary evil. The Bible makes work appear actually a glorious good. I mean, Adam is doing work in Genesis 2 before the so-called fall. So that means work is part of the good creation. And I think it's worth stressing this to people who sometimes feel they're in mundane jobs, not doing incredibly valuable things. From God's perspective, you are. If you are in any way contributing to the world, that you are actually doing a good and holy thing, and God loves it.
So let's see where this now all leads in the biblical narrative. Everything might be good, but it's not long before stuff turns bad.
Well, this is the second part of the Christian worldview. Genesis wants to make very clear that you understand that everything's good. And then once you understand that, it says actually human beings are a mysterious blend of glory and refuse. And it was, in fact, Blaise Pascal, the French philosopher and mathematician, who said, what sort of freak then is man? How novel, monstrous, how chaotic, how paradoxical, how prodigious, judge of all things, feeble earthworm, repository of truth, sink of doubt and error, glory and refuse of the universe.
Gosh.
I'm sure it sounds even better in French.
Yes, indeed. So in a way, then, Adam's story is our story.
Well, that is the point. I mean, the word Adam, the name Adam, is actually the Hebrew word for humankind. So it's built into Adam's own name that he is very much us, and we are very much Adam. And so what his actions against God are our actions as well. We repeat them every day in life. And it's important to understand what the narrative says Adam does. he eats of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And people sometimes think, hang on, didn't God not want him to know the difference between good and evil? Well, you know, that wouldn't be very fair. The important thing to understand is the word knowledge in Hebrew, very cool word, everyone should know it. It's Yoda.
Hit me with that.
Yes. Yoda. Which is how Wars character got it, right? But the Hebrew word for knowledge, Yoda, actually has a range of meanings. You know, it can even mean to have sex with someone, to know them in the biblical sense.
Yes.
It can mean just to know stuff, to discern the difference between things. But, you know, Yoda can also mean to be the determiner of something, to judge something to be the case, to decide something to be the case, not just to know it, but to decide it. And that seems to be what the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is about. Okay. It isn't just Adam wanting to know the difference between good and evil. It's him wanting to decide the difference between good and evil. He wants to be the arbiter. And man, oh man, that's us.
Hmm. Can you say Yoda once more?
Yoda.
You like that, don't you? It's interesting. So there's this great kind of moment between God and Adam. It is interesting how God is portrayed, or I might say verbaled, in the great temptation of Adam.
Oh, this is part of the beauty of this story. Satan says, did God really say you can't eat from any tree in this garden? What a stinge, right? Now, those of us who know the narrative already, no, that's not what God had said. God said, you can eat from anything in the garden but one tree. There's just one tree I don't want you to eat from. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. In other words, the tree of determining for yourself what is good and evil. That belongs to me. That's my fruit. That's what the context says. But Satan, of course, turns that into God's a stinge. Yes. He doesn't want you to have anything in your life. And I think what is so revealing about this part of the narrative is that it's what happens every day today. People think, or at least we're told, that God's ways are stingy. That if you follow Christ, it'll ruin your life.
Yeah.
It'll take the joy out of everything. When in fact, there is enormous freedom in following the ways of God. And the liberty of that far exceeds the so-called freedom to do whatever you want. I often describe the freedom that that the Bible speaks of is actually the freedom to be what you're made to be. It's a little bit like a fish, okay? Mm-hmm. A fish is most free in the water, right?
Sure.
Any fish who says, blow this water, I'm going for a stroll, right?
Yes.
Soon learns that he's not free.
Hop back in.
Okay, so free to do whatever you want is not freedom. I've just picked up surfing after a 25-year hiatus. Not altogether... Well,
you're still in one piece.
Still in one piece. But there are a few things that I do remember about surfing, right? Yeah. A few rules you should follow if you want freedom on the wave, right? You've got to stand toward the back of the board, okay? Yes. You've got to get up quickly on the board. And it's best to go sideways to the wave, not straight down the wave. Now, there are three things I know. If you do those, actually, it's a recipe for enjoying the wave.
Yes.
Now, if I decide I want to be free, I'm going to stand at the front of the board.
Hang
I'm
10.
Going to get up really slowly. Well, that's not freedom.
Yeah.
That's called getting dunked. And in life, it's the same. True freedom is not doing whatever you want. True freedom is being all that you're made to be. And in the Genesis narrative, we're told, you are made in God's image. You are made to be God's person on earth. And the best way to be God's image is to listen to him, not to defy him, not to decide for yourself what's right and wrong.
Okay, so in the biblical narrative, Adam doesn't get it. The fall begins, the curse begins, everything is unraveled in aspects of our life, in our relationship with God, with each other, and the creation itself.
Yeah, well, this is the structure of the biblical story, actually, because Genesis 1 and 2 describe the beauty of those three relationships. People are getting on with God, Adam and Eve are getting on with each other, and they're actually getting on with the physical earth because the garden is beautiful and fruitful. But in Genesis 3, once they disobey God, those begin to unravel. They're scared of God when he meets them in the garden, so that relationship's breaking down. Adam and Eve blame each other, right? The woman you gave me, she made me eat it, right? I mean, that's the beginning of a breakdown of relationship at the social level. But then we're also told that the earth itself is cursed as a result of this. So actually what the narrative is telling us is that human sin affects all of life, not just our relationship with God, but also our relationship with one another and the physical creation itself.
So people might say, okay, well, why, if God's so powerful, if he's the creator of all this stuff, why didn't he do it better? Why did he allow the fall?
Well, if he had made us without the capacity to say to God, you know what, I don't want to go your way, we wouldn't be sitting here today having this conversation about this dilemma.
Yes.
But we might be having a conversation about a more profound dilemma. Why has God made us without any capacity to exercise will?
Robots.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, we wouldn't be having that conversation because that sort of God wouldn't let us have that thought,
yes,
right? Let alone the conversation. I think it seems pretty clear that God has made us to be relational creatures. And the very fundamental of a relationship is the risk that the one you want relationship with will say, no thanks.
Yeah. Okay, so where to from here? We've got social unraveling. We've got physical unraveling in the creation and spiritual unraveling between us and God. Where to from here?
Well, the end of the Genesis narrative, Genesis 3, says that Adam was banished from the garden, so they're sent east. And there's a flaming sword and an angel at the gate of the garden blocking the way to the tree of life. And this really sets up the rest of the biblical story. Humanity is excluded from the presence of God, excluded from the eternal life for which we were made. And we're left asking ourselves, will humanity ever be able to eat from the tree of life? Will we ever be able to have the life God intended? And the answer of the rest of the Bible is yep, but you got to wait.
Yeah.
There's a bit of a course that has to unfold. And there will be one person ultimately who will go past that angel of death and actually suffer death under the judgment of God, so that we can eat again of the tree of life. And by the time you get to the book of Revelation, the last book of the Bible, the tree of life appears. And it says all those who are followers of Jesus, the Lamb, the one who was sacrificed for us, can actually eat now from the tree of life.
Mm. One of the great criticisms of Christian faith is how it seems to talk a great deal about sin and judgment, which is what we're talking about tonight. That it spends a lot of time saying no to everything. It is a great challenge that we've got to kind of own up to and confront, isn't it, within the Christian framework?
Yeah, it is. Christians have banged on about this stuff too much and sometimes banged on about it with a smile on the face.
Yeah, you know, we've seen that.
Which is not a pretty sight. So I would say Christians do need to learn not to be too negative with their doctrine of sin. But the other thing I would say is that the Bible takes sin so seriously because it takes you so seriously. See, if we didn't matter, right, if we weren't actually beings in the image of God, then our behavior wouldn't really bother God at all. You know, just be like ants. You know, an ant bumped into another ant, didn't say sorry. Well,
tough.
Who cares, right? It's an ant. No, you know, no, I'm not dissing ants at this point. But because we're so valuable, that makes all the difference. It's a little bit like... I used to own a Datsun 1200, my first car, right?
Cute.
It was an orange Datsun 1200, quite rusty. And I only spent $1,000 on it.
Okay.
Now, because it cost me so little money, I lent it out to my friends. You know, one of my friends in particular, Ben Shaw.
Oh, that's dangerous.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and because I hadn't invested so much in it, I wasn't that strict about how I used it. Now, imagine I owned a Porsche. Okay,
you wouldn't let Ben Shaw
no,
near it.
There's no way no. Ben's going anywhere near it.
No.
Sorry, Ben. You know, and I'd take it very seriously myself.
Yes.
Now, I think all I'm saying is this is a little bit of an analogy. If you don't think humanity matters that much, then you won't think sin matters. If you think humanity is made in the image of God with the high responsibility, the high value, then our defiance of God really matters.
Because people outside the Christian worldview would say, well, yes, I do hate injustice and those kind of things. So that is quite a universal thing in us.
It is. We are sort of wired, it seems to me, to actually think that human beings really, really matter.
Yes.
Right? That's our instinct. But the thing is, if you think we're just an accident, you have no rational basis for that instinct. It's just an instinct. And if it's just an instinct, you can override it and treat people like dirt, even if your instinct tells you that they're quite valuable. But what we have in the biblical view of things is not only an instinct that wants to treat people as valuable, we have a reason, a rational, intellectual reason for pursuing that instinct, because we actually think, no matter who they are, no matter how annoying that neighbour is down the road, they're made in the image of God. Mm. They have the high value placed on their life. So we can treat them with justice and compassion because they're such wonderful creatures.
Okay. So before we continue next week with our next kind of instalment in this journey, I always want to ensure on Open House that this tour through the Bible is not just theoretical or theological. What do we practically take out of the enormity of this narrative so far? Where's the rubber going to hit the road for us?
Well, let me just give you a couple of things. I think, firstly, when you really know sin in your own life, it removes the basis for judging other people, right? And because if you think we're all good, then every time someone lets you down, you're going to be outraged. How dare you? But if you actually know in your heart you are Adam, that you, just like Adam, defy God, then actually when you look at other people in their sinfulness, you can't really judge them because you know that you yourself are in the same boat.
That doesn't mean I'm devaluing myself or talking myself down.
No, it's in fact, I mean, the reason you take all this so seriously is because you know you're made in the image of God, right? So we're back to that idea. So we're holding these two things in tension, high value, but because of high value, our sins, our wrongdoing really, really matters. And the wrongdoing of other people really, really matters. But my point is, you won't judge them as something any different from yourself because you know yourself to be a sinner. I think it's wonderfully liberating. The other thing I'd say, and this is particularly, I guess, for people who have already sort of nurtured or beginning to nurture a faith, and that is, the deeper you know yourself to be in the wrong before God, the deeper your thankfulness to God will be that he loves you nonetheless, that he sent Christ to die for you. And I remember my little boy Josh, whom you know,
yes,
some years ago was caught in a terrible rip out at Avoca Beach. And by the time I noticed how far out and how strong this rip was, it was really quite a panic. But at that very moment I realized, and I was on the beach, I saw this lifesaver bolt straight past me, diving through the waves as, you know, they can, got Josh and dragged him safely into shore. Josh's first words... I was fine. I was fine. No problem. And I'm there going, Josh, you were not fine. You're that lifesaver just saved your life, right? And I thought, how tragic that he didn't really understand the depth of the problem he was in. Mm. And as a result, he wasn't very thankful for the rescue. And what I'm saying is the reverse is true. When you know yourself to be a sinner, lost at sea, and then God in his love forgives you, man, oh man, the thankfulness that this brings into your life is extraordinary.
John Dixon, I'm loving this journey, and thank you for tonight. We'll look forward to catching up next week.
Pleasure.
On Open House.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.